and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are Wembley bound in association with oldfootballshirts.com. So, after many years of trying, we've finally beaten Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, which wasn't so much of a beating, but a technical knockout which had the Chelsea faithful exploding and some wondering, what the hell is an on-season? That was a victory that has certainly helped our European ambitions and also went some way to exorcising some of the farcical Spurs demons from the week before. But the league will have to wait. We've got an FA Cup semi-final to look forward to. Yes, Wembley awaits our heroes with Man United waiting 40 years on from our last Wembley meeting. We should have won that one, so let's hope we can get one better this time. Joining me today as we look back on Chelsea and look forward to Wembley is, of course, Alan Wares. We welcome back Andy Bass, and we also welcome a raw virgin in the shape of the Guardian's John Bruin. Thank you so much for joining us, John. Lovely to see you. What the hell have you got against the House of Pain?
Well, I just think it's the worst record that's ever been released. That's all. I just hate that record.
So, when you say the worst record that's ever been released, I mean, obviously there's been some. That's a very long list, including some of like the FA Cup records that used to get released. Yeah. Boys in the Old Brighton Blue. United have probably had a few over the years, which I can't remember, which is probably a good thing.
I think I remember the Brighton one from '83, but no, actually. I think it's more the worst record that you'll ever hear a lot of, if you see what I mean. Like, so, say, I mean, by the look of it, maybe some of us are all a bit too old to do this these days, but you're out one night and then the evening proceeds and an House of Pain comes on and that's when I go and sit in the corner and, you know, sob. And you know, I just hate that record.
Understandable.
I used to like that song. It was a song they used to play at rock clubs back in the day, and it was like
It was like the rap thing. It was like, so you're there at rock,
It followed on from Aerosmith and Run DMC to House of Pain. It was like
Faith No More's epic into that, and it's a bit of a climb down, right? Yeah,
we were at the same club.
Yeah.
Listen, AD. I'm getting married next year, and we're already working on the playlist. And it's not so much what we are going to play, but it's what's on the band list. So I'll see your House of Pain and throw you Hi Ho Silver Lining, or even Oops Upside Your Head. So
yeah, okay, I'm with you on Oops Upside Your Head. That one can do. Let's talk about some football chats now. Obviously, been a great week for the Albion with the win at Chelsea. Finally, getting that Stamford Bridge hoodoo off the back. I mean. Before we were brilliant on Saturday, but Chelsea were absolutely woeful, we have to say.
Andy, did you enjoy yourself?
I certainly did. It was absolutely brilliant. Just a perfect day, actually. We had a nice meal in a nice Chelsea pub before the game. Nice stroll down the Fulham Road, go in and just watch the Albion take care of business. It was like, you know, it was like a top six team playing a mid-table team. And that's how you normally expect those games to turn out. It was just absolutely fantastic. I mean, we could have been three up after 10 minutes. And then suddenly we find ourselves one down after 13 from a deflection. But
yeah, overall, Conor Gallagher of all people.
Yeah, overall, just an absolutely incredible performance. Good mental strength, bouncing back from the disappointment of the previous week. You did wonder if it was going to affect the players. And if it did, it only made them more determined to win. And they never stopped going. Roberto might say they did stop going in the last 10 minutes, but the first 80 minutes was just a pile-driving performance for which Chelsea had no answer at all. It was just brilliant. One of the best away days for many a long while, I think.
John, you've been catching up on the Albion this season, admittedly with a neutral hat on rather than us Albion Raw types. Does the nature of the performance that Brighton put in, well, both against Spurs and against Chelsea, is that one of those things that surprised you, or have you seen this coming?
I wouldn't say that the performances against Chelsea and Tottenham surprised me, because I think Brighton have been pretty decent for a while now. And that includes, I mean, I think The first game I saw them under De Zerbi would be New Year's Eve against Arsenal. And I saw them earlier in the season, obviously, under Graham Potter. Are we allowed to mention his name?
Yes, that's fine.
Yeah.
We're, now he's gone from Chelsea.
You're okay. You're cool with him. No, and the thing, and I was a fan of Graham Potter. But I think a poor fit for Chelsea. But I just think that the Zerbi style, they sort of they press so high up, they push and they drive the opponent to distraction. And if you've got opposition that leave spaces, which Liverpool did, I went to the Liverpool game, which, you know, for you chaps must have been an all-time great because they absolutely destroyed them. And as poor as Liverpool has often been away from home this season, they are still a decent team, as Manchester United know all about. That game in particular, but obviously I was at the Tottenham game where they were very unlucky, of course, you know, through VAR decisions. Though I did think, and I got a bit of criticism from your brethren in the Brightons, saying that they lost concentration a little bit, you know, because all that stuff went on with Stellini and De Zerbi and obviously Mr. Atwell's decisions, and then he let Harry Kane in to score. And I'm not sure that they produced that much after that. But I was the thing about the Chelsea win is it was just came as a surprise to absolutely nobody. And that shows you how far Brighton have come as a team. And I think in De Zerbi, I think you're going to be quite lucky. I hate to say this. You're going to be lucky to hold on to him because he's like one of these hottest properties in football, guys. And the thing I always thought about Graham Potter at Chelsea, sorry to mention him again, is, and I have this theory, is that to manage the top clubs across Europe and specifically in the Premier League, you need that rock star element. Now, as much as Graham had the haircut of an Ocean Colosseum member,
I always said the chair of the Paul Weller fan club, actually, but yeah, carry on.
Yeah, exactly. I think some of Ocean Colosseum play with Weller, don't you? But I was going to say, De Zerbi's got it. Like, he's got that charisma. And if you go to his press conference, I'm sure you're aware of, one of the things about De Zerbi, there's always some beef with somebody. I think there was one with Trossard earlier on, I think after the Liverpool game, and obviously the Stellini stuff. Like, this guy's just got real gravitas, and he's great fun.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Potter, we've said it on the show several times before, John, is the fact that if he had gone to United, if he'd gone to a Liverpool, even if he'd gone to Spurs, he would have probably gone with our blessing. But we always said the fact that he went to the toxic environment that is Chelsea, he's never going to be given the time, or that the fans were never going to give him the time.
No.
I mean, he works better with a smaller squad of players. He always has done. He needs to have the players with him 100% of the way, because he will change systems 4, 5, 6 times during a game sometimes. And, you know, when you've got 30-odd, 40-odd players, you can't drill that into every single one of them. And it was never going to work. And then, oh, let's throw some more players at it. And then it was never going to work for him. So, you know, the way it happened and where he went, obviously that left a very, very sour taste in our mouths.
And then we went and thrashed them anyway. So
and then we took them to town, and you know, and De Zerbi actually said in the press conference after the Chelsea game that actually this was a better performance than the one that we beat when we beat them 4-1.
I just want to pick up on John's point there about, you know, the whole notion of hanging on to De Zerbi. I mean, there's a couple of cautionary tales that I throw into that one, into the mix. One is Potter himself leaving, and I think actually turns up as a cautionary tale to understanding about the whole notion of square pegs and square holes. You know, like I say, Potter was a good fit for Brighton. De Zerbi is a good fit for Brighton. It does not necessarily follow that they're going to take their success elsewhere. Of course, every manager wants to have a go at managing at the big clubs, but there's two that specifically spring to mind that he just cannot and will not go to. One is Chelsea, just because, and one is Spurs, because let's face it, you know, just taking a look around what he's seen in the dugout there, he's realising that that is equally toxic. If he's going to go anywhere, I would really strongly suspect to be back to Italy. However,
Juventus is a talk, isn't it? Or that was some I mean, there was a rumour, I don't know if you heard this, you know, going back, say, January, February, that De Zerbi had already, you know, been on the list of clubs, and there was some of that talk going on. I don't know how true that was, but listen, we assume this type of talk goes on all the time, right? Yeah. You know, I mean, as soon as an Italian manager, and someone with a good reputation in Italy as well, and obviously done a great job at Shakhtar, and in Italy, there's a shift of managers. Some certain clubs aren't doing very well. Napoli have run away with the league. Okay, who's next on the list? De Zerbi's going to be one of those choices. You do wonder. I suppose the only thing is, though, that for managers from around the world, the place to be, as it is for players, it's the Premier League. And we'll just have to see if that's enough to keep him. Because I do think I'd like to see a full season of De Zerbi at Brighton, see how far he could take him. Because you've had him for almost a full season.
Yeah,
I mean, I see him in Europe as well.
He hasn't had a close season yet, has he? So he
yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's. I mean, obviously, I mean, we've been following Brighton for like over 40 years, and it's like, you know, we've been from the top to the bottom and back again, and it's like, you know, we know where it's at, and you know, when Gus Poyet left, he was talking about glass ceilings. Now, I don't think there is that glass ceiling anymore. No. I mean, there is a very, very good chance. I mean, it probably won't happen.
There is one.
I mean, okay, there's the Leicester. Yeah, you can do the Leicester, but you see that we see where Leicester are now. That's the thing. You can risk it all and go for it, which Leicester did do. And then, you know, things can go against you. Changes in, in a case of Leicester, their ownership aren't as rich as they used to be. And that's what can happen. And maybe that might even happen to Tony Bloom. We don't know that.
I think the D-Day with Leicester was the helicopter crash.
Yes.
I don't think they've quite recovered from that. And I also like to think that the likes of Tony Bloom and Paul Barber and David Weir actually see Leicester and Southampton as a role model to aspire to, or what they had, but also as, again, once again, a cautionary tale, and have learnt their lessons from how they managed to sort of bounce up. And then, I mean, look at West Ham again. They've managed to, you know, hit the heights of sort of sixth and seventh, and have struggled once they got into Europe. And if the Albion get into Europe, and I still maintain it's an almighty if, then, you know, we know that the club is actually putting his plans into place. Are they going to work? Only time will tell. So, I mean, we'd like to think that everything is being put in place, but then that's looking at it from the Albion tinted glasses sort of perspective. What is the nature of the sustainability of where we're at? Well, we'll find out in a couple of years' time.
For sure.
For now, having said that, I mean, as I'm sure you can appreciate, John, we're just enjoying the ride.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, actually, I was chatting to a friend of mine earlier today. We were talking about Mitoma. Now, I must admit this, I didn't realise he was a Brighton player until after the World Cup. And then suddenly, and he'd been really good. And I look at this World Cup, he was so good at the World Cup. And then suddenly, and this guy in the second half of the season has been top three, four players in the league, and was just absolutely sensational.
Unplayable.
Absolutely brilliant. And you wonder with a player like that where the top is. And, you know, you chaps know far more than I do. Brighton have resisted money for Caicedo. But how often can they resist the model you talk about there? You know, this idea of Southampton, of Leicester, when they get asset strips, as both those teams have, that's when you run into problems, and that's when you need the forward planning that Paul Barber, Tony Bloom, etc. are going to have to be on the game to deal with that, because that day will come.
The thing is with Mitoma,
players
though,
will
as well.
Want to play for those clubs. That's the thing. You know, just as Graham Potter went for it. Yeah. I'm sorry to say this, chaps. You know, they have to accept that if you are Alexis McAllister, you are going to want to play for a Real Madrid. You are going to want to play for a Liverpool. Yeah.
Andy.
Yeah, I mean, on that particular point, I don't think that's anything. I don't think we're as fans, we're as concerned about that now as we would have been maybe 18 months ago.
No, because, absolutely not.
Because of the way that we do manage to unearth players. And also, selling a player on for a vastly inflated fee is kind of like the business model now. Now we've got it up and running. We do have, you know, more than, you know, three or four players that would probably be, we could probably sell for a lot of money. But really, as part of the business model, we only need to sell one. And I think we would. I would be stunned if we didn't sell anybody in the summer for the amount of money that we want to receive for them. But I think if we do get that sale, then I think it does strengthen the club's hand in keeping the remainders whilst we train up their replacements so that we can replace them for a fiver whilst they go dancing off into the sunset with a million, with the million stuffed in their back pockets. But and we do have a lot of exciting players at the moment that we haven't really had a great chance to see, and of which in Julio and Ciso is one.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, of course.
So he's announced himself this weekend to the wider public, and obviously the club will be hoping he has a more significant role in the team as we go forward.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly it. I mean, basically, it's all about the next cab off the rank. And, you know, we let Bissouma go because we knew we had Caicedo. You know, McAllister is going to be attracting a lot of interest. I know it's not the same position, Al, but, you know.
No, but the point I was going to make is that just rewind this time last year, Caicedo was an unknown who just, probably around this time of the year, scored his first goal against Manchester United. You know, with the story being that Manchester United could have had him for Tuppence Halfpenny. And that was the main story. Now look at him. You know, we're refusing bids in January for 70 million. They, irrespective of the fact we've actually signed him on a new deal, you'd like to think that clubs would respect that. No, they're not going to. So up goes the money again. And who knows? I mean, Christ, are we looking at a nine-figure fee for Caicedo? Or is it a case of he just sticks around? Because, and this is where, you know, again, we're not going to know for the next 6-7 weeks. And I think this is going to be a crucial time in the, not in the club's history, but certainly in the here and now, is whether we do actually get into Europe, because it's going to be not easier, but I think it's going to be more attractive for us to A, retain our current players, and B, maybe acquire some more if we're going to be playing in Europe. And it's a stepping stone for absolutely everyone involved in the club, because apart from probably Danny Welbeck and maybe Joel Veltman, I don't think hardly any of them have played in European club competitions.
No, Tomer wouldn't have done, would he, for like USP last year? So, no.
Funny enough, you mentioned the Manchester United game last season. There's a guy that made a breakthrough in that game as well, Cucurella. Now he's become five. Well, you see, there you go.
That was a masterclass in pulling your pants down, that was.
Unbelievable. That he's become a byword, hasn't he? And I feel a bit sorry for him, because I wonder if, like, if people in Spain watch the Premier League and think, who's this guy? Oh, he's Spanish, you know, because it's, I know he's played, I think he's probably played one game for, I mean, that is, I mean, you know, we could talk about Tony Bloom's genius, but if that is, I mean, wow. 60 million for him. That was a great deal for you. I wonder actually how you chaps feel about him, because did he make it difficult to leave, or was it? I mean, you've got to feel sorry for a guy that it's not worked out for. I was going to say, because
he took a good half season to get up and going, but then after Christmas, he barely put a foot wrong and was absolutely brilliant. And we loved him for it. That goal against Manchester United, you think, absolutely superb. He was our player of the season, so that's how much we appreciated him and loved him. And we're back to square pegs and square holes again. You know, and the grass is not necessarily greener over there.
Especially not there.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, this is why I'm minded to believe that of all these players that we've got that are being sniffed around over the summer, the likes of Caicedo could probably benefit from another year here. Maybe McAllister, he took a while to bed in. Cucurella was here for 5 minutes. The only one who's here for 5 minutes and has and that left and has flourished is Ben White. But apart from that, some people just moving on far too quickly. We even said Potter, you know, Bissouma, he could have done with another year here.
Yeah, this goes back to the point I was, I was saying 2 minutes because basically it was again going back to the next cab off the rank. So Bissouma went because we had the cover at the club already. There's lots of talk about McAllister going to this club, that club, and the other. But if he does, we've already got his replacement at the club probably.
That's the point. We don't know. I mean, I think that the club will only let go that which they know they can replace.
Yeah, we won't know that until
the summer.
But I mean, we're talking Buonanotte, we're talking Iari. These are two players that play in similar sort of positions to McAllister, who are incredibly highly rated by the club, and there's only 11 places on the pitch.
But they can't
play them all. At some point these players. They're going to get an opportunity. So, same with Onciso. He came on in the first half after an injury to Joel Veltman. So Pascal Gross went to right back, and he came and he was absolutely brilliant.
But don't you have to remember? Absolutely, and he was for the most part. And we're going to get onto De Zerbi's criticism of Onciso in a minute. But don't forget, if the rest of the first team squad was fit and ready, Onciso wouldn't be playing. Lallana would be ahead of him.
Mm.
But yes, I mean, and then Caesar has come on before as an early substitute and really looked horribly out of his depth. So the leaps and bounds he's made have been absolutely superb. And yeah, for a time, he ran Chelsea absolutely ragged. And you could see, you could feel that a 25-yard screamer was coming because, let's face it, he tried two or three times before and he's tried it in other games. The criticism that came afterwards, and it sounds harsh, given that we've got this 19-year-old kid who's opened his account at Stamford Bridge in front of the world, and everyone's going, Christ, Brighton have got another kid off the rank.
Yeah, I forgot about that. But in this instance,
it came to the last 15, 20 minutes. Well, De Zerbi said he stopped playing, but the upshot of it was that the ball was being played to him and he was being out-muscled too easily. And so Chelsea were able to win the ball back quite quickly in a way that we had been doing for the rest of the game. My looking at it, and I said this to you at the time, Adi, was I think they should try and make Danny Welbeck the out-ball because at least he can hold the player off. De Zerbi, all right, he obviously clearly knows a lot more than I do, was saying that Enciso wasn't doing his job. It's kind of interesting he's going to have that public criticism, but if they deserve, will know his man. And if it's a public kick up the backside that Enciso needs to do his job, then good for him. And this is how we'll see he'll react, because there is obviously now, given the injuries, a good chance that Enciso will play at Wembley. And what an opportunity.
Well, De Zerbi's exact words were, no one will remember that goal if you don't win the game.
Well, Yeah, I think his head was in the clouds a little bit, and it's about the mentality. But it's what, his fourth game for us. He's only just out of nappies.
11th game,
and he
actually
did brilliantly. So Andy, you're up.
It was his 11th appearance.
Was it 11th? Yeah, but he's not started a game, has he?
No, he still hasn't started a game though.
No. Andy, you're on the shelf. Andy, you're on the shelf for that match. Did that goal make you jump when it went in?
I had to double take. I was in like, I just couldn't believe I'd seen it, and then the ball bounces out about 20 yards out there, and then we just go absolutely loopy. I thought that was I know he did get criticised for his, maybe being a bit wayward at the end of the game, but I thought, given that he came on for Veltman and De Zerbi reorganised it, and he and Ciso was an incredible attacking force prior to his goal. He was incredible. He brought that in. He's always had the raw talent and enthusiasm, but has maybe kind of lacked the craft at the senior level until Saturday. And I thought he did show a maturation in the way he played. There was one time where he was running into the area, and he was going to shoot. He could see Matoma to his left. Now, he did take the shot, but at least he recognised that Matoma was there, because he thought, well, this is a good opportunity. And the shot he took was good. It was fine. And Pepper saved it, but you could actually see him thinking, because his instant reaction would be, I'm just going to shoot this. But he actually did think about it, and then he made a decision. And you could
rather
actually,
than just heads down, he
yeah,
made.
And you could actually see that. You could actually see that from stands. It was really impressive. And if you're going to lose your head in a game, you're going to do it after a goal like that.
But I mean, that's what I loved about Danny Welbeck's interview after the game when he said that he made a run when Julio got the ball, and he goes, I knew he was never going to pass to me. I don't know, why am I making this run? But yeah, it was a strange substitution, I thought, at the time. But it was, because, I mean, Veltman, who's one of our senior defenders, let's face it, he was having a torrid time against Mudryk, already been booked. And then it looked like a hamstring or a muscle
strain. Are you questioning De Zerbi here?
No, but I mean, I Pascal Gross, who's... I mean, we've said it before. When he runs at full power, it looks like the Baywatch titles. He's like he's running in slow motion. So him up against Mudryk was a bit of a worry for me at the time.
Even though it's a waste of his talent,
very well.
Even though it's a waste of his talent, he is experienced at right back, and I was quite comfortable with that. Now, John,
yes.
Before I make this next point, let me ask this question of you. You sat in the press box for many a game.
Yeah.
Tell us about sort of like the, I don't know, the aura, the behaviour of the, whether it's writers or broadcasters, when a goal is scored. I mean, the point I'm making here is you should just sit there and describe it, don't you?
I know where you're going here.
Well, I do, yes. Yeah. Have I ever cheered a goal in the press box? I don't think I ever have, you know.
I'll tell you what it was in the Chelsea press box in that case. I just wanted to have it that this was the point that's being made here. It was like someone had put 250 volts up every seat, because everyone just sort of got off their seat for about 6 inches. Remember, they were in the press box and sat down again.
Really? That's interesting. What? Because this is Brighton or Chelsea fans?
This is in Ciso's goal.
Right, I see. Yeah, well, funny if I was at... I was at Chelsea the week. In fact, the last time I was at Chelsea was the final reckoning of Graham Potter, in fact.
Right.
And there's a stadium where actually I always find Stamford Bridge, as it is now, quite atmospheric. You really get a feel of the fans. They don't have to get on the back if they're no good, do they?
Oh, yes.
Obviously, in the press bit, you're right behind the managers as well, so you see you see it all go off, and it's a good ground to see that type of thing. Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is at Chelsea, they've seen a lot of that go on this season. Frank's in charge, they've probably seen a lot more of it as well.
Yes,
yeah. I mean, it's Brighton. I was going to say, actually, maybe you could put Evan Ferguson. What's the word there, chaps? What's the
apparently he's going to miss the semi final. I think he landed badly when he had that header. It wasn't a clash or a foul. I think he just landed badly.
Yeah, he twisted his ankle, and it's like and our hench like physios like helped him off. And like
you love using that word, and I've no idea what it means.
That's because you were born in the 60s. What can I say? You know, us people born in the 70s know what it's all about.
I was going to say, no, I mean, Ferguson, he scored his first goal, didn't he, on that New Year's Eve game against
Arsenal? Yeah, he did,
sort of comeback. And funny enough, I do quite a lot of work with some Irish people, some Irish journalists. And they were saying, oh, did you see this Evan Ferguson? You know, and I was like, well, I've got to be honest, lads. We were reporting on Arsenal, you know, they're the best team. And you barely notice a guy that scores what's a consolation goal. And then suddenly he goes on this run and he scored. I was at the Leicester game away where he scored that fantastic late goal. And he is a very special talent from what I've seen. I suppose the worry that you would have, I'm sure you will have, is that a couple of injuries happen, and he is of that sort of build, isn't he? If they start getting ankle injuries, that tends to be a concern. Harry Kane, permanently, whenever the ball goes near him and his ankle goes, you think, right, that's it for him. Obviously, to be honest, Carroll.
Nobody needs to be near Harry Kane anyway for him to go down. I mean, we were telling this story last week, John, about the fact at Spurs where he went down claiming a free kick after he'd been taken out by his own player. It was.
I feel a bit sorry for Harry Kane at Tottenham, you say, because he has to forage for absolute scraps there and he'll take what he can get. And he does quite well with it, we have to say. No, Ferguson, I just think it was described to me, I think it was you probably read these quotes, the Isle of Manager, Stephen Kenny, was talking about how, because of the way De Zerbi runs the team, it's almost like Evan Ferguson is withdrawn. Because you've got Solly March, because you've got Mitoma speeding on, he's almost playing like a sort of number 10 role off them because they are the foremost attackers. It's such a, you know, it's against orthodoxy, isn't it? And he looks like a, you know, your classic centre forward, your young Alan Shearer or something like that. But actually, he does have that little bit more of a touch, doesn't he? A bit more like Kane, maybe, you know, because Kane always had a bit more touch than people maybe gave him credit for when he was a younger player. But he does look sensational. And, you know, as I say, I do quite a lot of stuff over in Ireland and have a lot of Irish journalist friends. And the excitement over him is getting very, very silly.
Well, do report back to them that we're actually just equally as excited. And obviously we get to see him week in, week out. And there might
another one who's just signed a new contract as well.
Yeah, and when the form dips, you know, he still might actually then still go back to the under-23s. You know, should something like that happen, because the club will look after him, make sure he gets his game time in. But he's clearly good enough for the first team.
He's well advised, isn't he? Because his dad is he was an apprentice at Coventry, worked for the FAI. And, you know, this is, I mean, you had a, what was the young Irishman he had before? It didn't quite work out.
Connolly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, talented player, not on that level, but, you know, maybe a bit less, better advised. Let's put it that way. I think Evan Ferguson is someone who's guided by someone who knows what he's doing, knows the game. And I think clearly, you know, 2 or 3 years, if he continues on that trajectory, then, you know, you are going to get he's going to be attracting the big clubs who want to sign him. But, it's good that he signed a new contract. I think that's good news.
Absolutely,
Brighton's the right place for players of that promise, I think, at the moment. But and I think that's a reputation your club's got, hasn't it?
You know, absolutely, it'd be nice to think that we're more than a factory. But actually, Andy, can I upset you now, mate?
Okay, go on.
Evan Ferguson's dad was born in 1979.
His dad was born in 79. Oh, shut up! Yeah,
I was 12.
you're old enough. No, you're not old enough to be his dad's granddad, but he's great granddad.
I'm old enough to be his granddad now, I think.
It was a terrific performance at Stamford Bridge. It's one that's going to live long in the memory. And obviously, you know, Danny Welbeck scoring with his first touch, Mitoma almost scoring what a Ricky Villa kind of goal of that would have been. I mean, if that had gone in. And on Caesar had still scored. I mean, that would have been a goal of the season contender in the same game for the same team.
Well, John, your colleague Jonathan Wilson, he said, I think it was on the Athletic podcast. I think it was. I could be wrong. He'd never seen such a one-sided 2-1 game. He said until 20 minutes from the end, where it was 1-1. He said it was quite embarrassing because he thought, I'm going to have to write something about this, and yet the score's completely wrong.
Well, yes, we've all done that, Andy. And you sometimes your report bears no relation, really, to what's gone on. That game in particular, it just sounds like they gave Chelsea a right caning, and we're just waiting for the goal to come, really. And I have to say, as I said before, it wasn't unexpected. Brighton are a far, far better team than Chelsea this season. And approve that all season.
Okay. You are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast, and now on SmartSpeaker. This show is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Over 130,000 shirts of every colour, creed, and everything for you to look at.
But Phil can tell those colours apart.
He can, and I think he can tell these ones apart, but he has given us a shirt of the week to look at. So, John, if you could have a go at describing that shirt for me, if you've got it there.
Well, it's green and white stripes. What would that be? Vertical stripes.
I think it's Rotolock or something, isn't it?
Yeah, Rotolock. What do you think that is? Some kind of...
It's like the one of the crook lock things, isn't it?
Yeah, some sort of... I was going to say car spares of some description.
Yes,
yeah.
Can you identify the maker and therefore and also the badge?
Not from this viewing, right. No. Hang on, let's see if we can get this up.
Okay, Andy, do you want to take over, mate?
Yeah, this is Plymouth Argyle.
Yes, it is.
so much for the description.
So it's obviously an Admiral kit. So we've got the lovely old Admiral logo as well. And looking at the button collar and the way that we've got sort of black and white little sort of stripes, black and white stripes and green blocks on the sort of fringe of the collar, I'm going to say this might be like an early 90s.
Yes, it is.
Oh, interesting. Very good. I would have thought it was a sort of late 70s one, but it was just an Admiral Revival period then.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the Italia 90 shirt in like with the collar and stuff. So that's kind of why I thought early 90s for this.
Well, I thought it was someone like Sporting Gijón or something like that. It had that continental edge.
Yeah, I'm just glad he's given me an English shirt. After spending the last week trying to speak various different foreign languages, this is
abroad, AD?
I might have been, Al. I might have been.
Who knew?
Anyway, this is what Phil has to say about this particular shirt. This is the 1992 to 1994 home shirt of Devon's finest, Plymouth Argyle. This shirt would have been worn on the 17th of March, 1993, when the Pilgrims put the Albion to the sword, winning 3-2 at Home Park. Phil says, I missed this trip to Plymouth as I had the temerity to get married on that day 30 years ago this week. And now you know why he's chosen this shirt.
Right. Happy anniversary, Phil and Lou.
Happy anniversary, Phil and Lou. Argyle, as they're originally known, were formed in 1886 and they turned professional in 1903 and adopted the full name of Plymouth Argyle and using the nickname The Pilgrims. There is conflict as to the origins of the name Argyle. Some think the club was named after the Argyle and Sutherland Highlanders, an army regiment with an affinity to football. Others think there is a local link, either from the pub called the Argyle Tavern, where the original players may have socialised, or possibly after a local street called Argyle Terrace. Home is the imaginatively named Home Park, which can cater for up to 17,900 pasty aficionados, thank you, Phil. The club has won both the League One, Tier 3, League 2, Tier 4, a few times, with a few promotions and relegations, and made the semi-final of the FA Cup in 83-84, when they lost to a single goal away at Watford. A notable former player is Paul Mariner, who began his career with 135 games for Argyle in 1973. In 76, he moved along to Ipswich, playing 260 times and scoring 96 goals, and he went on to play for Arsenal and Portsmouth before ending his career in the North American leagues. And of course, there's some notable former Albion players. Gary Nelson was voted into the Argyle team of the century. He played for the Pilgrims 74 times between 85 and 87 before he's moved to Brighton in 80, where between 87 and 91, he carved out the best of his career with 144 league appearances, scoring 47 goals, taking on 892 players at Brentford before curling it into the top corner. Fred Binney was with the Seagulls between 1974 and 1977, playing 70 times for us. After a brief stint in North America, he moved back to Plymouth, his hometown, and signed for Argyle, where he spent 3 seasons at Home Park before moving to Hereford. So thank you very much for that, Phil. Now, we've got a small matter of the Wembley awaits the De Zerbi Heroes, where we will take on Manchester United 40 years on from the FA Cup final. John, you remember it?
Yeah, it's actually one of the first matches I remember. I was born in 76, so I'm about 7 years old. And it was that week I was converted to Manchester United by my two cousins. I grew up in Macclesfield, sort of, and then from Stockport, edge of the Manchester conurbation, Greater Manchester, that very controversial area, actually, if you're interested in refereeing these days. And so, yeah, this game. Now, funny enough, the game I remember more, and you may call this glory hunting if you wish, is that's a replay.
It was a replay?
Yeah, from what I'm told. Yes, you know. What do I remember of that? I mean, obviously this is in retrospect, but there's I hope we're allowed to mention him, but Ron Atkinson, there is a great bit where John Watson says, Ron Atkinson savours the moment, and you see Ron there suddenly looking all solemn, and then he just breaks into this total cackling laugh almost into the camera, which I always thought was a great, great piece of footage. But yes, I was actually thinking, are you chaps all headed to Wembley in Steve Foster headbands? Is that the...
Well, I headed to Wembley. I mean, I was actually the same age as my daughter, 11. And it was one of those days. It was pouring it down with rain. I mean, there's certain things you remember from that day. You know, the team boarding a Chinook to take a British Caledonian Chinook to take us to a park just outside Wembley, and then getting the coach for the rest of the journey. You know,
wow. That day. My dad used to work for British Caledonian. So there you go. There is some more symmetry for you. So, funny enough, when I was at Brighton, maybe last time I was down there, there was the pre-match presentation, and they had Gary Stevens, who, of course, Stevens scored, didn't he, in the first game? Is that right?
Yes, he did.
And I believe you just compared to Jazz Coleman from Killing Joke this week.
Well, they do look quite similar, don't they? I think. but he there's a well-preserved man, Gary Stevens.
He is. We've had him on the show a few times. He's a lovely guy.
He looks exactly the same as, I don't know if you recall this, but Wackaday used to have a football expert, and it was Gary Stevens. And of course, he, in the 80s, and I remember that he played a part, I think, in England's third goal against Paraguay. And he came back onto the programme after being in Mexico, and there was this great big fanfare for Gary Stevens. He was always my favourite Gary Stevens of the two.
Andy, you would have been a neutral back in the day of 83. Were you rooting for the underdogs that day?
Yeah, I was rooting for Brighton. Obviously, I wasn't really much of a Manchester United fan. There's too many Man United fans at my school. I was supporting Man United or Liverpool. It was very interesting. But I do remember it. My abiding memory is of Steve Foster being out for the first game and then being back for the second game. And I was thinking, what a difference you had made.
Yeah, that's what they sung to us.
Yes.
Yeah. That is
sadly my abiding memory.
There was a banner in the crowd, like Whiteside on his backside, I seem to remember.
The reason that Foster was suspended and was that the nature of yellow cards and red cards and disciplinary points worked slightly differently, where nowadays it's an immediate ban. In those days, it didn't kick in for a week or so. So what had happened was it was something like the penultimate league game of the season. Against County, and I think there was the game that actually sent us down. I could be wrong, but I think it's the game. Anyway, Foster picked up a booking, which meant he would have missed the final, and he spent the rest of the game trying to get sent off. Deliberate handballs, clattering into people, shouting, punching, hitting people, and the ref just would not send him off. If it had been sent off, his suspension would have been immediate, and that would then have put him in place to play the final. So, yeah, I mean, imagine getting a carte blanche to actually just knock the living daylights out of your opponents just so you could play in the FA Cup final. Well, it doesn't work that way now, but...
That is hilarious. Yeah. I would have loved to have seen that.
you tell me, who was the player that played instead of Steve Foster, chaps? Do we know?
Well, Stevens and Gatting played it in the centre-back.
So, wow, yeah. I mean, that's evocative, isn't it? Gatting.
Absolutely.
And the fact that Tony Grealish walked out as temporary captain wearing Steve Foster's headband
came back for the replay, what had happened was that Norman Whiteside had absolutely, because Chris Ramsey, He was only 21. It was only about his 10th game for the Albion. He had Whiteside in his pocket, and Whiteside said, I'm not having this. He cropped him.
And did normally.
And he had to miss. Yeah. So Stevens then moved to right back, and then it was Foster and Gatting as centre back for the final. And you know, I think what had happened was in the replay, sorry, was as the Albion came out a little bit more, because we had a very sort of defensive setup in the final, the original game, and then sort of broke away and scored those couple of goals. But it's that whole thing of leaving gaps when you're trying to be a bit more adventurous, and United just picked us off that night. So, you know.
But of course, you can go to the Albion Raw archives and you'll find interviews with most of that team. We've spoken to Gordon Smith several times and he's still maintaining.
Still apologising.
We're still maintaining it wasn't a bad miss. It was a great save. But
tell you what, John, sorry, in that case, you're saying...
I've met Gary Bailey. He was a nice guy as well, you know.
You're saying Gary Stevens is well-preserved. Have a natter with Gordon Smith if you get an opportunity. Now, there's a well-preserved fella.
Oh, really? Well, didn't he move into sort of officialdom or something like that?
Yeah, he was the chief executive of the Scottish FA for a while. He was chief exec at Rangers for a time as well. Actually, he did actually apply for the job at the Albion, but didn't get it.
He was the one that actually brought in the rule about, through Scottish FA, then through UEFA and FIFA, about, I can't remember the name they give to it, but it's basically how they work out who's going to get credited with a goal. It was him that came up with the idea of, you know, and takes a shot and it's going wide and it gets deflected in, it's an own goal, and so on and so forth.
The biggest thing he was actually was retrospective action. So basically, you could actually still get suspended if video evidence proved that you had done something wrong. And I imagine
a lot of that went on in Scottish football in the 80s and 90s. So.
I'm just still delighted their refs are sponsored by Specsavers, but that's another story.
Let's move this on to this week then.
Obviously, if we look back 40 years, the Albion had just been relegated. United hadn't won anything for quite a while. Fast forward to now. United haven't won anything for a while. Actually, that's not strictly true. They won the League Cup this season, actually, didn't they?
Yeah.
But they've already been to Wembley this season. Brighton are on the crest of something very, very special. This game, it's intriguing. I mean, to a neutral, you probably couldn't call it, could you? Well, you're not neutral, but...
I'm fairly neutral, don't worry. The fervor left me some years ago. But what I would say is... I heard, and you know, was that the Brighton are actually favourites for this game, and we're in this situation where Brighton are favourites for games against Manchester United and Chelsea, which just shows you again, as I said before, how far they've come. I think that is a lot to do with the schedule that Manchester United have been through, and the fact that there will be no Rafael Varane, there'll be no Lisandro Martinez, Harry Maguire. Good luck. So actually, so the defense is that would make it Luke Shaw and Lindelof, would it not? So, which actually Luke Shaw, I think, is a reasonably serviceable centre back. He's a good player, Luke Shaw, when he's on his game, which, as we know, is not always the case. Rashford missing, we think. I don't think Ten Hag's pulling any punches on that one. It's an understrength Manchester United thing. My concern about Brighton is, does the occasion get to them, which it always will with a smaller provincial club. Yeah. Sometimes that can happen, can't it? They go to Wembley, everyone gets excited, and the big day out doesn't quite happen as they might. And, you know, they're not used to playing on that Wembley service, which isn't as wide as everyone says it is. But, you know, that would be my concern.
John, I would like to point out that we've got a World Cup winner in our side and Danny Welbeck.
Danny Welbeck is fairly notorious in Manchester United for missing big chances. Remember Fergie's final European game against Real Madrid?
Yeah.
There is a pearling miss by Danny Welbeck, who I really like as a player and as a guy too, I should say. But, you've got a World Cup winner. Actually, United, have they got a World Cup winner? Because actually, their World Cup winners are absent now because Varane and Martinez are both out. So it's okay, 1-0 to Brighton. Okay.
I'll take that.
We'll come on to you in a sec, Andy. But in just closing your opinion on this, then, John. Seriously, guns ahead. Can you call this game?
No, I think it's very difficult. I suspect this feels like an extra time one to me. It feels like socks around the ankles, you know, shouting to the use of substitutes. Funny enough, I think there's been a bit of criticism of Ten Hag's use of substitutes, as you will know, as a guy that defies orthodoxy. I know you were talking about it before. Deserbi will throw in a substitute at a time when no one will really expect. It's going to be interesting, and it will be a test of the squads. Now, when you look at what's going to be on the Manchester United bench, you might even say that the Brighton bench might be stronger. I do think it's going to be very close. I do think on games like that, it's to do with the players that can take games by the scruff of the neck. Who are those players for Brighton? Well, Mitoma, Danny Welbeck,
McAllister,
obviously. Yeah. I mean, listen, I'm beginning to worry when we were running us through there.
Sully March.
I don't know if you saw this a few months ago on Twitter. I tweeted out saying, what does Solly March's mother call him? Because everyone calls him just Solly March, full name.
Yeah.
And she replied, Solomon. So yeah, she listened. Which I thought, so hello, Mrs. March. It's very tough to call. And when I'm thinking about it, where are Manchester United's match winners going to come? Martial is a maligned player. He will probably play. You've got Antony, a player who is one of those players that fans look at and think he's not really doing enough. He seems to have one trick, but he has a bit of a taste for the big occasion. And then you've got Bruno Fernandes, who I say this as a Manchester United fan, I find as a player quite hard to like.
We find him very hard to like. I mean, unfortunately for me, during the,
you're not going to mention this one again.
Yeah, I bloody well am. we were very lucky to be able to go to the games during lockdown. But I was at that game when United were awarded a penalty after the final whistle, which Fernandes put home. And you know what? I mean, we're still not saying, we're still not arguing the fact that it was a penalty. It was a penalty, although once you blow the final whistle, that's a bit hard. We're still wondering where the after Solly March equalised in the last minute of injury time, where they managed to find the extra 6 minutes for them to actually score to achieve that penalty. It was
We're back to the greater Manchester conspiracy then again, aren't we?
Yeah, so big six bias easily. Listen, Andy, we just said the last 6 minutes of John sitting on the fence. So if I can't get an answer out of him, can we get one out of you? Can you call this game on Sunday?
Yeah, I think we'll win it.
Okay.
Good. I think it's our best chance. We can go in. It's not like 2019 where we went into the Man City game thinking, well, yeah, we've got a puncher's chance, but we're probably going to lose this one. I couldn't really see a path to victory in that game for the Albion, but I can see a path to victory for the Albion in this game. We play Manchester United quite regularly now, and we normally play quite well. I think the win...
Have we beaten them this season?
Yeah, well, I think the win at Old Trafford was a big deal at the beginning of the season, and that was under Potter, by the way, but... Because we finally cracked that nut. Because we'd actually, the last few games we'd had at Old Trafford, I thought we played quite well, but somehow we didn't win the game. United us, really. Basically, they just they had that extra quality. They had that maybe that little extra bit of luck or whatever, but they had that bigger team quality that we were lacking. Mm. And this season, we actually, obviously played Ten Hag at the right time because he was just getting into the job. But mentally, I think that was a big hurdle for us to do. And I think that's helped give us the belief in these games against the big six.
And we don't go into those games with any fear anymore.
No, I don't think we do. Mostly because we play on the front foot. when we do make it difficult for the other team to get the ball, but instead of just passing it around at the back, we pass it around the back a bit, but we're always going forward, and we go forward quickly now, whereas Albion teams in the past would have lots of possession, but it would be quite slow. It'd be quite easy for teams to intercept. And it's harder now. I think it's going to be an intriguing battle when you've got like Caicedo up against Fernandes in the middle. That midfield battle is going to be a real treat. I think this is going to be a great game for the neutral. I do think this will be an entertaining game. And why not? Why not the Albion? I think United have got a big game on Thursday. They should have been able to coast it, but they can't. They've got to take Sevilla seriously. I mean, if they can get some early goals, maybe they can put that to bed early. But it's got to be done, and then they've got to play us. And at this level, that is a grueling schedule, and we for once have the advantage of a little week off.
Of course, we also have the intriguing prospect of the fact that Ten Hag and De Zerbi haven't faced each other yet.
No.
What a time for the pair of them to actually come up head-to-head, face-to-face, toe-to-toe, man-to-man, coast-to-coast, do the hucklebuck.
I suppose the thing is that, of the two, we knew about Eddie Howe, of managers this season that have made an impression, you'd have to say those are the two, really, wouldn't you? Arteta's obviously had a great season as well, but those have been the new arrivals on the scene. And just thinking of Eddie Howe, United may need Brighton to do a Newcastle and freeze at Wembley as they did when they all got terribly excited about it all. Mm. And it got to them. I think Brighton seems to be taking it a little bit more coolly, as you said, Andy. They've been there before. The puncher's chance is a very good way of putting it away that you'd have. It's more than a puncher's chance. They really do have a good chance. Mm. The pessimist suggests I think Brighton probably could win this. I mean, listen, and if you're a Manchester United fan, of course, the one thing you don't want to do is get to the final and get gubbed by Manchester City. So losing to Brighton might not be the worst.
Let us get gubbed by Man City.
because I don't listen. This is the problem of the elite football fan. I remember games where United could play Liverpool in a Champions League final. It's like, I'll take losing against AC Milan because I don't want to lose against them in the final. The pessimism that can...
We always seen that. I was just going to say, it would be probably good for us to have United win on Thursday night, so they've still got something to play for this season. So,
well, I think it's actually going to be that Sheffield United get to the final. How's that?
That would be
fantastic, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Yeah, and then both teams are screaming. They're just going to tear lumps out of each other if Sheffield United get to the final.
Well, at least we know in advance. Okay, well, that is all we've got time for. So thank you so much to Alan Ware. Thank you to Andy Bass. Thank you so much to John Bruin. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb. 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and on our podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and we will see you all again next week, where hopefully we'll be celebrating being in an FA Cup final. See you then. Bye.
The mama pajama rolled out of bed and she ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout and he started the investigation. It's against the law. It was against the law. Oh, what did mama saw? It was against the law. The mama looked down and spit on the ground every time my name gets mentioned. The papa said, oh, if I get that boy, I'm gonna stick him in the house of detention. Well, I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going, I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye to Rose, the queen of Corona. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. see me and Julio down by the schoolyard. Gonna take me away, but the press let the story leak. Now when the radical preach come to get me released, we is all on the cover of Newsweek. And I'm on my way, I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way, I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye to Rosie, the queen of Corona. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard.